Mr. Bernanke dispenses with many of the criticisms of low rates with which Mr. Chancellor is taken. What his account lacks in vivacity, it makes up for with analytical clarity. For example, he gives short shrift to the idea that loose monetary policy prolongs the lives of zombie companies, whose capital would otherwise be reallocated to more productive endeavours. If interest rates are low because desired saving exceeds available lucrative investment opportunities, then of course capital will flow to less profitable ventures instead. Low rates do not tie up capital, but make things easier for entrepreneurs who wish to borrow. Such an argument might not have the luster of references to intellectuals such as David Hume or Frédéric Bastiat, but it is coherent. By contrast, the price of time reads like a jumbled collection of every criticism to have been levied at low interest rates. Mr. Chancellor argues that low rates benefit financial interests, then laments that they damage bank profits. He says low rates hurt retirees by making annuities unaffordable, but also that they benefit the elderly at the expense of the young by pushing up property prices. It is not always clear whether he thinks low rates lead to too little investment, too much investment, or investment in the wrong sort of things. Messrs. Chancellor and Bernanke do agree that low rates increase financial risk-taking for reasons that economists do not fully understand. In theory, low rates should make credit cheaper uniformly. In reality, the riskiest borrowers benefit the most. But whereas Mr. Chancellor sees this as sufficient reason to raise interest rates even when the economy is weak, Mr. Bernanke sees it as an issue that is too little understood to form the basis of a monetary policy. Should the Fed ever raise rates to try to contain financial excesses? In principle, yes, says Mr. Bernanke. But in practice, very cautiously, and not very often. Hence, there is an amusing contrast between the book's assessments of loose monetary policy after the global financial crisis. Mr. Chancellor blames it for almost any ill he can identify in the American and world economies. Mr. Bernanke regrets not having stimulated more, given how much the economy subsequently undershot the Fed's employment and inflation targets. Again, it is Mr. Bernanke's account that is more convincing, for the simple reason that critics of loose money in the 2010s repeatedly predicted severe instability that never came. It took the pandemic to cause markets to crash in the spring of 2020. Central banks' recent blunder has not been allowing excessive financial vulnerabilities to build. Their misstep has been a failure to control inflation. On this point, readers are likely to find Mr. Bernanke's book unsatisfactory, probably because it was written before the extent of the problem became clear. Readers may scoff when he describes a burst of inflation troubling the economy, or labels Jerome Powell, today's Fed chair who has looked hapless as inflation has risen, a consummate 21st century central banker. Though the lengthy discussion of alternative forms of stimulus may prove relevant again later in the decade, it will seem academic while central banks are desperately raising interest rates to get price growth under control. Still, at least today's central bankers now recognize the importance of inflation targets. Mr. Chancellor would overturn their primacy in pursuit of amorphous goals. His worldview has much in common with the liquidationists of the 1930s, who thought the Depression, in which America's unemployment rate reached nearly 25%, was a necessary purging of the economy. At one point, he argues the 1930s weren't so bad after all, because productivity growth was high. By all means, enjoy his colourful challenge to conventional wisdom. But when the time comes to appoint a central banker, choose someone like Mr. Bernanke.